today's special guest, Gary Dorsch. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome our featured guest today, Gary Dorsch, formerly with Charles Schwab and Company, now publishes independently Global Money Trends newsletter, and he's also an independent trader and wears many other hats and monikers. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, and glad to be with you today.
Pre-interview, you talked about the markets, and you know, we've seen a lot of volatility. I mean, yesterday our discussion with Peter Schiff included the recent yuan devaluation, the impact that had. On the whole, there are many disturbing events occurring in the currency market. Vietnam also devalued its currency. We're also hearing about, give us an idea of what you see happening here.
The issues that you just mentioned, the severe devaluations of a whole slew of emerging currencies and U.S. dollar strength against the G7 currencies is a very big focus of the market's attention right now. And last week's devaluation of the Chinese yuan was also a very big event, which is now having ripple effects even a week later as we speak. The significance of China's devaluation was that it caught the market completely by surprise. There was no advance warning of it. In the past, when China was shifting its currency policy, there was as much as 6 months to 8 months in advance notice of discussions about a possible shift in policy, which normally was due to massive pressure from other trading partners. But this was completely unexpected, and it represented a major shift in China's yuan policy. For the previous 10 years, China acceded to the demands of its trading partners to strengthen its currency. And over a 10-year period, the Chinese yuan strengthened by 28% against the U.S. dollar. At the same time, because the Chinese currency for the last year or so has been roughly steady with the dollar and almost pegged to the U.S. dollar, we saw the Japanese yen and the euro drop by 20% against the U.S. dollar over the past year or so, and so therefore the Chinese yuan also strengthened by 20% against the European currency and the Japanese currency, and almost 15 to 20% against the Korean, and also by dramatic increase against the value of these emerging currencies. The Brazilian real, the biggest economy in Latin America, has dropped by 53% compared with a year ago, and the Russian ruble down 80%, some of the more extreme situations. And therefore, China is becoming increasingly uncompetitive in the world markets, and its exports are collapsing and contracting for the first time. And this is a severe problem for China's economy, as it still depends on about one-third, its exports still account for one-third of its growth. So we now see what this devaluation meant was that China was basically admitting that its economy is hurting badly from this drop in exports, which is due to the adverse currency fluctuations against the yuan. So it aims to try to correct things by weakening its currency, but it's got a long way to go to catch up to the devaluations of the Japanese yen and the euro and all the other major currencies. Even the Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar have dropped by 20 to 25%, while the yuan was holding steady with the dollar, and they can no longer compete in world markets. So it's a recognition that China's economy is growing probably much slower than the official statistics would say. The government says the economy is growing at 7%. But now most analysts are saying it's probably somewhere in the 4 to 5% range. And you can see that by the collapse in commodity prices. This is the other part of this whole story, is that the strong U.S. dollar is also exerting massive pressure on commodity prices. And today we're looking at the price of crude oil at just over $40 a barrel on West Texas Sweet, and North Sea Brent breaking under 50 now at 47. And for Bakken crude oil, Bakken shale oil, at $36 a barrel, putting most shale oil operators into below break-even levels. So massive pressure on commodity producers as a result of this strong dollar. And now if the yuan begins to decline, the yuan will put even further pressure on Asian currencies, and making the U.S. dollar even stronger. And today the price of copper, $2.28 a pound, and we're seeing a massive drop in the price of Freeport, the U.S. largest copper miner, and most importantly, dropping under $10 a share today, and its bond prices are collapsing, which means for the first time, bondholders in Freeport are concerned that the company may not be able to service its debt. And when you get to that situation, it's very severe. And we're seeing a lot of these commodity producers seeing their bonds falling substantially and raising their interest rates, which means the industrial sector is in severe trouble. And yet the Federal Reserve is preparing the market for an increase in interest rates, which can only support the U.S. dollar, I'd imagine.
First, like to backtrack to your bullet point that officials in China are recognizing and they're starting to adjust expectations. Of course, we also saw the blow-off peak in Chinese equities and the Shanghai Index and related indexes there as well. So let's start off, if we could, with the greenback and just how you see the strength here. Is this an anomaly from your perspective? Are you on board with us that we may be looking at a more of a sea change event here in the primary trend?
For the next year or so, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan are going to continue to massively print their currency through their quantitative easing schemes at a clip of about $65 billion worth of euros and $65 billion worth of yen every single month will be injected into the world markets, and that puts a lot of downward pressure on those on the euro and yen. Even if the U.S. was not to raise rates, which would force it to drain liquidity in order to sustain an increase in U.S. rates, the dollar would go higher when you have Europe and Japan actively trying to devalue their currency through QE. With the Fed now, I think we'll probably raise the rates by 0.25% next month, and that'll force it to drain some liquidity in order to sustain the slightly higher interest rate, which makes the dollar more attractive. The other key issue is that in the emerging world, there's trillions of dollars that are owed in U.S. dollars by emerging corporations. They have to buy dollars in order to pay their debts, in order to pay the interest on their debt. And so they get very panicky and they're buying the dollar because they're worried that the cost of servicing that debt will increase as the dollar rises. So the Fed will probably take all this into account. My guess is the increase in interest rates by the Fed is going to be much smaller than in previous rate hiking cycles, no more than two increases from an eighth to a 0.625% by the end of the year. And then they'll see how things look. But if there's a lot of devastation in commodities and in emerging currencies, the Fed may just stop it right there and leave it there for quite some time. If you take a look at a 50-year chart of the federal funds rate, you're seeing that the Fed funds rate has been pegged at an eighth of a percent for 6.5 years. And I guess, you know, you kind of lose your perspective when after 6.5 years, people begin to think that an eighth of a percent is normal. It's not normal. It's highly abnormal. Fed funds at an eighth of a percent for 6.5 years. That interest rate was more appropriate for a time when we were losing 700,000 jobs a month and we were in a financial crisis. It's not appropriate at a time when the economy is generating 200,000 jobs or more a month for over a year and a half and growing at 2.5%, and auto sales are booming at record levels, and housing prices have gone up dramatically from their lows. So it's not appropriate. And people are, the reason you're hearing this objection to raising rates is a lot of traders have become addicted to the cheap money and they've made leverage bets, betting on cheap money. And so they will have to adjust their thinking accordingly. The reason the Fed will raise rates, if they do, and I believe they will, is they're going to follow the advice of the Bank of International Settlements, which said about a month and a half ago that higher interest rates were necessary not because the economy is growing too strong, not because there's an inflation problem. Higher rates were necessary to try to bring monetary policy back to some type of normality and to, most importantly, head off the possibility of even bigger and bigger bubbles in the equity markets. Because if bubbles grow in equity markets and then burst under their own weight because they're unsustainable, that can also do damage to the economy. So to find the happy medium, they recommended that the Fed start raising rates just a little bit. And that will shake out some speculators in the equity markets. We're starting to see a little bit of that today. Yeah, at this point in time, most traders in the stock market, U.S., do not believe the Fed will raise rates. And so it will be a shock to them if they do. And we'll see how all that proceeds. But I believe the Fed will follow the advice of the Bank of International Settlements to normalize policy to a certain extent.
Well, I share those sentiments, and I think it's just obvious if you actually read through the headlines and just the commentary from the Fed itself that they mean business here. This is not a bluff. I think it would absolutely destroy any credibility that they have left were they to backpedal. This, of course, assumes that we don't see a massive 10-20% decline in equities or, you know, let's talk about this junk bond market. There's been some talk from several different sources, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, the Economic Collapse blog, massive increase in yields that we've seen. The last time there was increase of this magnitude, I think we could look back or hearken back to 2008. We all know how that ended up. Why don't we delve into whether or not you see any similarities between 2008 and today?
I'm looking at a lot of junk bonds on my screen right now, and they're all pretty much in the energy sector. Those are the ones I look at every day. And the $1 trillion junk bond market, about a quarter of that's in energy companies. A lot of those companies started exploring in the shale oil industry here in the U.S. and borrowed money in order to fund their development, and they did not expect the price of oil would be at $36 a barrel for shale oil. About a year and a half ago, or just over a year ago, it was over 100. Of course, if it stays down here for an extended period of time, these companies are going to start burning cash, burning liquidity, and their bond prices are already dropping significantly, and their cost of borrowing has already gone up. This is where the major danger lies, and in other producers, even Freeport BBB rated bond is now seeing its bond prices fall to 97 cents on the dollar. They were just about 110 cents on the dollar a few months ago when copper was trading at a higher level. It's never exactly the same, but sometimes history does rhyme, but never exactly the same. I believe a few years ago, that was all kind of triggered by the banking sector, the crisis in the banking sector, which would have led to a big cutoff of lending for all companies. This is kind of more specific just to the commodity resource-based companies for now, as far as the threat to the junk bond market.
Let's move on then to the precious metals sector, mining companies. We all know we're back in, by many metrics, to sub-year 2000 levels. Just because things are down, as we all know, they can remain lower for a indefinite period. Give us an idea of what you see in this sector, maybe if there's any silver lining.
I often kind of remind my readers that the two biggest buyers in the world are China and India, so we have to kind of consider economic conditions there, the mindset there. And then I think the other major factor behind the gold market is the general trend in commodity prices. I don't trust government statistics on inflation. I don't think many people do, but I've always used the trends in commodities as some type of leading indicator of where inflation might go. The U.S. CPI uses commodities or goods-based components for about 40% of the CPI, but in India and China, commodities can make up anywhere from 60 to 65% of their consumer price index, what most people buy every day. And in China right now, the producer price index is down 5.4% from a year ago, mostly reflecting the drop in commodity prices, and the consumer price index up 1.6%. And even in India, which had a big inflation problem of about 9 to 10% for consumer prices, that's now dropped down towards 4% and is sort of declining with the downturn in commodities. So investors in gold in those two areas are seeing declining inflation, and were more inclined to buy equities and trade the stock market than they were to trade gold in order to stay ahead of monetary inflation. There was a big shift in investor psychology in India and China, where they started plowing money into stocks. We saw both the Bombay and the Shanghai stock market go up dramatically while gold prices were falling. And I felt those traders in those countries were shifting their psychology, which was a major shift, and preferred to buy stocks. Now they're getting hurt in the stock markets there, and so they don't quite know where to go, but they're not running back to gold so quickly. And in the meantime, the price of gold here has dropped significantly, as we all know, briefly under $1,100 an ounce. What I typically do when I show the price of gold, I always show the year-over-year change in commodity prices. And right now, the equally weighted commodity index put together by Thomson Reuters is trading at 396. That's below the key 400 level. That is down 22% from a year ago. That's an equally weighted basket of 17 commodities. And as we've already talked about here, copper at 228. And there's also severe weakness in agricultural commodities and corn and soybeans and wheat and sugar, 1061. I believe that's about a 10-year low. And of course, the energy complex and the coal complex and ethanol all under severe weakness. And beyond that, iron ore and natural rubber and Shanghai all significantly weaker. There's not much inflation out there. And these downturns in the commodity prices have also had a negative influence on the gold market. Now, gold has rebounded here by about $40 or $50 an ounce in the past few weeks. The rebound was triggered by China's devaluation of the yuan. If you go back and look at the chart, that's the rebound began when China made its devaluation. So there is some factor there. I think the thinking is, if China is going to try to weaken its currency, it'll need to buy some U.S. dollars in order to do so. And once it buys the dollars, what will it do with the money? In the past, it's always put a lot of it into U.S. treasuries, but the hope is they may diversify and maybe buy some gold instead. I think that's kind of the reasoning behind this recovery in the gold market. So if China does devalue its currency further, and I believe they'll be under pressure to do so, given the severe weakness of their economy and the misalignment of the yuan with other currencies, the thinking is they will continue to buy some gold to diversify. On the other hand, the upside is sort of limited because of the severe weakness in commodity prices and what looks to be a general trend of a weakening global economy due to the with China leading the way down.
On a more forward-looking basis, let's project forward 12 to 18 months. Where do you see things headed from here?
Well, it's also important to realize the top 8 gold miners in the world have been able to reduce the cost of production, their all-inclusive cost of production in the last few years. One of the biggest costs is energy, and that's dropped dramatically. And they're also benefiting from weakening local currencies. The average break-even cost for the top 8 gold miners is now about $950 an ounce. They can sell gold at $1,000 an ounce and still make a profit. Although about half of the world's gold miners now have a break-even of probably closer to about $1,150, and they're losing money at current prices, they may have to start cutting production at some point. All that means is essentially, I think $950 would be a floor for the gold market. And I think the lowest you would see gold possibly go over the next year or so would be about $1,000 an ounce. Gold miners can still make money at that price, the largest 8. But many are losing money right now and may be forced to cut production, which is a supporting factor. I think the upside for gold would be about $1,200 an ounce, which would support at $1,000. So I'm giving myself a $200 range, and I don't really see it going outside of that range. If the Fed does raise rates 2 times between now and the end of the year when dollar gets stronger, The price of this rally in the gold market could fizzle out at around 1170 or so and then go back down towards its most recent lows of 1080 and possibly slightly lower down to 1050. So that would be my projection if the Fed does raise rates. If the Fed does not raise rates, if it gets cold feet, if it gets worried about what it's seeing around the world and doesn't raise rates, then the gold market will hit the upper end of that range, I would predict, around 1170 to 1200. So that's kind of where it's all at in that regard.
Well, my current target is 900 to 1,000. You know, I'm a huge proponent of the precious metals as an excellent portfolio balancer. They do that better. Anything else? I'm sure you're watching all kinds of interesting developments here. Any topicality that I've left out that you feel is pertinent to the listening audience today?
I think we've caught a lot of it as far as commodities and currencies are concerned. My prediction is that if the Fed does raise rates, as I suspect, and we'll see the euro drop towards a dollar even from about $1.10 today, and the dollar will go from about 124 Japanese yen up to about 130 yen, and the emerging currencies will fall even further. There'll be a lot of severe weakness in foreign currencies. If they go forward with that, that'll keep a lid on the commodity markets and the gold market. And that's, that's the million-dollar question, which everyone will be speculating on. Will the Fed go forward with what they've already telegraphed, or will they get cold feet at the last moment? So it'll be great drama going into that September 16th to 17th meeting. My guess is they will go for an increase in interest rates because the goal here is to head off bubbles in the equity markets, and there are quite a few of them in the NASDAQ market for sure.
Particularly the S&P 500 is just loaded with parabolic charts, actually some, I think, approaching vertical asymptote. But even though momentum, I think, is starting to pull back, I think investors are going to be surprised. You know, the shorts are going to be surprised. For instance, during each subsequent pullback that we've seen on our favorite seven indicators here, sentiment indicators, and what that typically means is this bull market may still have some upside in the next year or so, because typically we would see a very high level of, as I mentioned, complacency and bullishness during each pullback if this were really a market top.
Well, there's a lot less liquidity in the market. The trading volume has dropped by 20 or 30%. One reason is a lot of investors have switched to ETFs, exchange-traded funds, and instead of diversifying into many different stocks in their portfolio, they just buy one stock. And so for that reason, there's fewer shares that are traded, and there's therefore you often see the market making sharp moves, and it's really kind of deceiving because there's just not much volume behind it, and then things just sort of reverse on their own. So in other words, also be aware there's a declining amount of volume in the market, and therefore subject to wider fluctuations than otherwise, and a lot of meaningless noise. The high P.E. ratios are mostly in the NASDAQ stocks, and you have a concentration of just six or eight stocks that are holding up the entire S&P 500 right now. If you look at the up and down volume for the day, or the new highs, 52-week highs and 52-week lows on any given day, you will see anywhere from 2 to 3 times as many companies ending lower for the day than went up, even when the market goes up, which means that the broad market is actually weakening, and there's a lot less breadth in the market, and therefore this is not a very strong rally, and it's sort of just being kept up by a few companies. We'll see the true face of the market. As far as the stock market is concerned, we'll only see the true face of the market when the Fed starts to normalize its monetary policy and gets us off the 0% policy. That's where we'll see how things pan out. Historically, the first few interest rate increases don't really knock the stock market down significantly. There may be sharp downward moves for time beings, but they come back quickly. They see the increase of interest rate as a sign that the Fed feels confident that the economy is strong enough to stand on its own 2 feet. And so they can spin the news as being bullish. But at some point, if the Fed does continue to raise rates, if they were to move them even higher next year, towards 1.5% or 1.75%, then I think 10% to 15% correction in the stock market at that point.
Gary Dorsch, I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling folks a bit more about Global Money Trends, your newsletter, and any contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners today.
Actually, I am speaking to you from my townhome in southern Florida, and this December will be the 10th year anniversary that I've been writing the Global Money Trends newsletter. It's a unique newsletter. It gives readers an opportunity to see charts and graphs that you can't get elsewhere on the internet. And I focus a lot on intermarket technical analysis. I like to show how different markets affect each other. As an example, I'll be putting up a free article on my website at searchartsalot.com. You can also go to globalmoneytrends.com to see the article, and you'll see as an example a graph of the German DAX index overlaid by the value of the euro versus the Chinese yuan, and you'll see a very strong degree of correlation. And this devaluation of the Chinese currency against the euro has had a negative impact on the German stock market. So I explain why that is the case, and just gives readers a greater understanding of what's moving all these various markets. And I cover a lot of territory. I cover a lot of the currencies and commodities and interest rates and discuss all these matters with a lot of very interesting charts and graphs. You can get a good idea of the type of work I do by going either to searchartslot.com or globalmoneytrends.com. And
Gary Dorsch, we appreciate your thoughts. Look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Thank you very much, Chris, and best of luck to you in the markets, and thank you very much.